Okay, so let us come back to the suttas on the biography of the Buddha. And so we're trying here to kind of see how the Buddha discovered this middle way, how he strove, and you know, it's interesting because it kind of sometimes it reminds us of our own striving. You can almost like you can see yourself there almost to some extent in what is going on, trying to find this way here. And even for the Buddha, of course, it would have been much more difficult because he didn't really have any path. He was really striving in the darkness, whereas we have all of these wonderful teachings to give us guidance, which is great. Anyway, as I said before, I really enjoy this biographical suttas, and it brings you closer to the Buddha, and it gives you a feeling of almost being there when you read these things. So let us then continue and see what happens next year. So the Buddha has just found this place, the delightful grove at Uruvela, and he continues his practice from there. And this is one of the first things he says after he has arrived here. He says, "Now these three similes occur to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, 'I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat.' He would not be able to light a fire or produce heat. So too, as to those recluses and Brahmins who still do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge, vision, and supreme awakening here. So here the Buddha-to-be has kind of understood for the first time the problem with sensual pleasures, how they actually stop you from the profound insights and the profound attainments on the Buddhist path that are required to take you all the way to awakening itself. So why is it? Why is it that he understands this at this particular point? What is it here that is going on? And one of the things that is going on here is that he has just finished his apprenticeship with these two masters of samadhi, Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta. So he has just been through like a long course of samadhi practice. And that, of course, gives you the information you require to understand what sensuality is about. Samadhi is precisely the emergence from sensuality. For the first time in your life, you have climbed that mountain. You've got out of the jungle of sensual pleasures. They're always enmeshing you, tying onto you, holding onto you, making life so difficult. You can never see far ahead. You can never see far to the right or to the left. For the first time in your life, you emerge from this. And you can see the horizon. You can see far away. You know, there's Ajahn Brahm gives this teaching about when he went to the Yucatan Peninsula in Guatemala, and he went up on this ancient Mayan pyramids. And that similarly is also found in the suttas in almost exactly the same way. And I think it's coming up later on, actually. And very beautiful simile about what it means to kind of emerge from the hindrances and emerge from sensuality. So because the Buddha-to-be has emerged from that for the first time in his life, he has this bird's eye view, this ability to see things from above, to understand. You can only understand what sensuality is when you are completely freed from it. As long as you are immersed in it, you have no perspective, because it's part of you in a sense. Once you emerge from it completely, that is the first time in your life you have perspective, you can see what's going on. So that old simile of the tadpole becoming a frog and getting out of the water, same kind of idea. So this is, I think, what is going on here. He understands this fully for the first time. And so he then rejects, obviously, the sensuality. And as you might expect for somebody who rejects sensuality, we'll see that in a second, he then moves on to the ascetic practices. That's the next thing that he does after this. Here he is only talking about bodily withdrawal from sensual pleasures. The bodily withdrawal is known as the kaya viveka in Buddhism. So the first thing, if you want to overcome sensuality, is that you have to withdraw physically from that world of sensual pleasures. And this is one reason you come to a place like Jhana Grove, yeah, because you are withdrawing from the city, withdrawing from the usual sensual pleasures that you have around you, the entertainment that is always there, and all of these things. And you live a simple life at Jhana Grove. It's quite nice, isn't it, to live a simple life? Isn't it quite beautiful? You know, don't have all of those things that oppress you all the time, all of those things around you. It's actually there's something very wholesome about that. The mind becomes more at ease and more relaxed. The simple life, there's actually a lot to be said for a simple and easy life like this. And that's, of course, it's good to have that attitude if you're a Buddhist monk, otherwise you might have a problem. So it's actually a very helpful thing to move towards a monastic life as well. So this is the first part of having success in meditation practice, kaya viveka. You come here to jhana, it's not 100% kaya viveka, but it's pretty good. The next step is finding a kuti for yourself. Yeah, and so one step at a time. And then from that comes the citta viveka, becomes possible after that. That is what comes up next here in these similes. And the Buddha, he says that... Again, a second simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land, far from water. And a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. He would not be able to light a fire and produce heat. So too, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, but whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed. Not sure about the word suppressed, abandoned, and basically abandoned is good enough. Internally, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision of supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertions, they're also incapable of knowledge, vision, and supreme awakening. So here, the Buddha-to-be is saying that it's not enough to live secluded by body, to live far away in a kuti, in the forest or whatever. You also have to eliminate those sensuality, sensual feelings, sensual thoughts, sensual perceptions from your mind. And only when you do that, is the mind ready for these insights, for the special states that we're supposed to achieve on the Buddhist path. And these states here are called knowledge and vision. Knowledge and vision is jnana dasana. It's one of those basic things, seeing things according to reality. And then supreme awakening being probably arahantship, probably reference to that. Should maybe say here that you wonder what this recluses and Brahmins is all about. And this is just a reference to those who practice a spiritual life. That's really what it means. And then he says, again, a third simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water. And a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. He would be able to light a fire and produce heat. For the first time, you are not only are you secluded by body, it is far away from the water, but you also have dried out inside, the sap is all gone, the upper fire stick and the wood is all, everything is dry, and that is when heat becomes possible. In the same way, you practice to get the kaya viveka, first of all, and from that kaya viveka comes the citta viveka, the aloofness of body or the seclusion of body, and also the seclusion of mind. Seclusion of mind means essentially seclusion from the sensual world. That is the main idea of seclusion of the mind. Yeah, the mind which doesn't go to sensual pleasures, which isn't interested in those things, but what you're interested in rather is the happiness that comes through meditation practice. And you know, the This is not something that happens like that. It's something which kind of comes and goes a little bit. And you will notice that this on the retreat, you know, people often come, oh, I was going really well, and then kind of it went down the dumps. Not now, you know, how do I get back there again? Yeah? And this is kind of life. Things always go in waves. Things come and go. Sensuality, the movement from the spiritual, the worldly life to the spiritual life. It doesn't happen all in one go. Yeah, one day you are a layperson, and then you are bang, an arahant the next day in robes with a shaven head, yeah? It doesn't work like that. It's a very gradual thing. So you enjoy the meditation for a while, then the sensual desires kind of return a little bit, and you enjoy the meditation again, and it kind of goes in waves like that. But there's a trajectory, a general movement which moves in the right direction. And that is a general trajectory. That is what matters. So there's still the waves, but the general trend of the waves is upwards, is in the right way. So don't despair if you feel that your meditation was going well, you were getting nice and peaceful, and suddenly you're not. If you despair at that, all you're doing is giving rise to craving. I want to get it back again. How do I get it back? Somebody asked me about how do I get it back again? That's already the wrong question. How do I get it back? Because that means that you're trying too hard. So just chill. Enjoy. Yeah. Do whatever, but don't kind of desire to get it back. Ask yourself, why did I get there in the first place? And that is the right kind of question. So why did you get there in the first place? Well, because you had the right attitude, you had the right inspiration, you had the right sila, you had all of these factors coming together. So how do you get back there? Then the meditation will also come back all by itself. The simple things that are required in meditation practice. Simple things I talked about on the very first day. Your attitude, yeah? Are you coming from kindness? Are you coming from gentleness? Have you got a sense of compassion and metta for your meditation object? If you hate your meditation object, do you hate your meditation object? If you hate your meditation object, it's going to be really hard to get samadhi, yeah? And I've heard of people who hate the breath, and they learn to hate the breath because they tried so hard to hate the breath. Not to hate, they tried so hard to watch the breath for so many years that eventually the breath is my worst enemy, yeah? And if your breath is your worst enemy, basically, you know, forget it. Leave the breath aside, change your attitude completely, come back in 2 years' time, and then try again, yeah? That's the kind of right way of doing things. So be very careful not to do things with willpower, with force, in such a way that you end up hating the breath, hating Buddhism, hating all the monks, hating everything, and then, you know, and then giving up, and ultimately giving up on life itself. Yeah, this kind of, that's, please don't do that. Be gentle, be kind, have the right attitude. Then you're going to make progress. So you are aloof, chitta viveka, secluded from the sensual pleasures, secluded from the five hindrances. Yeah, this always usually goes together. If you are completely secluded from sensual pleasures, it usually means the hindrances are pretty much gone as well. And this is when the fire can light the fire. Yeah, the fire, which is the blit, is like the flash of insight, the flash of lightning that somebody mentioned in the question the other day. When you become a stream enter, or you attain a jhana or something like that. So too, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has been fully abandoned, not suppressed, because that gives completely the wrong idea, just abandoned internally. Even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. These are the three similes that occur to me spontaneously, never heard before. Of course, one of the points here, and this is the point that will come up next, is when the Buddha-to-be says that even if you do feel painful, racking, piercing feelings, you are still capable of knowledge and vision and awakening. Well, that is within certain limits. Yeah, there comes a point when there is too much painful feeling and too much problems, and then it actually blocks the path to awakening completely. So even if someone has very, very good samadhi, you can only, sometimes the pain can actually block you from even achieving the samadhi, even if your spiritual qualities are incredibly profound. Let alone if you are kind of struggling to watch the breath, which is most people have that problem. Yeah, just staying with the breath can be hard enough. Of course, it can be far worse. So the Buddha has understood the problem with sensual pleasures, why this is a problem. Yeah, and now, so one side of the equation of the middle way, he's got that. Now the question is the other side of the equation. So because of this, he thinks, yeah, and this is now taken from a different sutta, and a small little line that I have just inserted from that sutta, and he says, and it fits into the framework exactly, because the suttas are almost the same, the slightly different wordings. He says, I thought thus, pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure. Pleasure is to be gained through pain. Yeah, and this is follows naturally on from what he has been doing now. He has been deciding that sensual pleasures are problematic. You can't get there. So the next point then is to assume that, well, if it doesn't happen through sensual pleasures, then perhaps pain is the right path to awakening. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. And when the Buddha-to-be says this here, it is actually context. There's actually a prince, the prince called what is it called? Bodhirajakumara Sutta? I think it's the Bodhirajakumara Sutta, Majjhima 85. And he's called Bodhirajakumara, the son, a prince Bodhi, basically, is what it means. Prince Bodhi says to the Buddha to be, he says that, he says that he's already the Buddha at this point. He says to the Buddha that, happiness is not to be attained through happiness, happiness is to be attained through pain. And then the Buddha says, well, I also used to think like that, yeah? And this is where that is taken from. I also used to have that thought. So what the Buddha is saying there, essentially, is that I used to have wrong view. I used to have the wrong ideas about how to get to awakening. I didn't really understand. And because of that, I went through all of this time practicing, tormenting myself, practicing all this atta kilamatana yoga, self-torture, mortification and all of this, because I had wrong view. It's very interesting. Yeah, the Buddha had wrong view. One of the things that, not the Buddha, the Buddha to be had wrong view. One of the great things, one of the interesting things that comes out of the suttas is actually seeing what the Buddha was like before his awakening. Yeah, and of course, what you see there, you see him as a young man when he was kind of enjoying himself, yeah, like young people do. It's a little bit, the way they enjoy themselves in those days is a little bit different from now. It's very quaint, the way it is explained there, you know. He had three lotus ponds when he was a young man, one with blue lotuses, one with red, and one with white lotuses. That was how young men enjoyed themselves in those days. Yeah, it's kind of, it's very sweet, isn't it? It's very kind of quaint. And these days, things are just changed just a little bit, yeah, from what it used to be, at that time. So, but it also goes on. Of course, it goes beyond that as well. But that was kind of part of it. And I thought also that was quite interesting here. So he enjoyed himself. Yeah, he had a son, obviously, like we know that. And then he talks in one of the suttas, he talks about how he had defilements and how he actually overcame those defilements through his practice on the way to awakening. Yeah, he talks about having occasionally ill will, about having desires and delusion, all these kind of things. And he gives a teaching on how he overcame that through his own practice. This is the Buddha. Yeah, this is the Buddha to be. He's got only a few years perhaps away from awakening, and he has these problems, just like we have. Yeah, you're in good company. Yeah, we're all in very good company. The Buddha was there. In one way, it's inspiring, yeah, because you realize that actually you're not as far away from awakening as you may think you are. The Buddha also had to go through these things. And so in one way, it's actually very reassuring when you see that even the Buddha, who had all these spiritual qualities, had to pass through these things. And that's why it's very interesting. Here he talks about having wrong view. Yeah, we all have wrong view to some extent. So the Buddha had exactly the same problem as he was striving for awakening here. And it is interesting. It's very psychologically, I think, interesting, the fact that we all tend to think like that. That happiness is to be attained through pain, not through happiness. Yeah, no pain, no gain. Isn't that the kind of the old English saying? no pain, no gain. So, this is so true in almost all the religions of the world. They have these kind of ideas. How to self-mortify yourself, how to torture the body so as to release the spirit or release the mind or release the soul or the inherent good qualities in you. It's like somehow we understand that all these sensual pleasures, they confine us. And then we think that the opposite of sensual pleasures is to torture you, like as if you, by feeling sensual pain, you are neutralizing the pleasures. And out of that comes this kind of middle way, yeah? This is kind of seems to be the idea. And you find this in almost all of the religions of the world. Hinduism is famous for that, famous for torturing the body. Yeah, it's a very famous part of that teaching. Christianity had that in it. Apparently Islam also has kind of torturing the body in it. It's just so such a natural thing in humanity. It's almost built into our psychology almost. And that's why we have to be so careful not to go down that path. And that is why I think so many Buddhists actually go there too. Why? Not because the Buddha said so, but because it almost comes naturally for us to think, no pain, no gain. Yeah? Torture yourself a little bit, that's good. And then kind of out of that will come something positive. But no, and this is kind of the interesting thing. The Buddha, after saying this, yeah, I also used to think that happiness, pleasure cannot be gained through pleasure, pleasure be gained through pain. After saying that, he points out to Prince Bodhi, he points out the gradual training. The gradual training is one of the most beautiful expressions in the suttas of how you practice from the very beginning of the path to the very end. And one of the great things in the gradual training is the Buddha shows you how you move stage from stage to stage, one step to the next one. Each one of those stages gives rise to happiness to a certain degree. Starting off with the anavajjasukha, the happiness of being blameless. Yeah, because you're living well. So you're blameless. You feel good about yourself. Yeah? You don't oppress others, anything like that. Then you have the abhyaseka sukha, the sukha which is unsullied or unmixed, because not only do you practice kindly towards other people, but you don't have any ill will or negativity towards others inside. Yeah? And then gradually, stage by stage, higher and higher happinesses. This is the Buddhist path. Every stage, there's more happiness if you do it right. But you have to commit and you have to persevere. And so the point the Buddha is making is that actually happiness is to be gained through happiness. Pleasure is to be gained through pleasure. As long as you define the pleasure in the right way, then you are on the right track. So if you feel the pleasure of kindness, if you feel the pleasure of generosity, yeah, that pleasure actually does lead to higher pleasures. If you feel the pleasure of samadhi, boy, that pleasure really leads to even higher pleasures, the pleasure of awakening. Yeah, one pleasure leading to another. It's about how we define these things. We understand the distinctions of pleasure. That is the critical issue. And that is what is coming up soon in this particular sutta. But in the meantime, unfortunately for the Buddha-to-be, he has understood that sensual pleasures are no good, but he hasn't really got it yet that torturing the body is also no good. Yeah. So now, because he hasn't got that, he has to go through all this time torturing himself until eventually he figures out where he has to go. And this is the great thing about having the Buddha as your teacher. You don't have to follow these footsteps where he went wrong. Yeah. So please don't follow the footsteps where he went wrong. Follow what he did right. This is far, far more useful. So, coming back to the Majjhima 36 again. Yeah, these are the self-torments the Buddha-to-be went through prior to his awakening. I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and with my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain and crush mind with mind. So, with my teeth cleansed and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits, just as a strong man seizes a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him. So too, with my teeth cleansed and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. He's taking no prisoners, he's really going for it. Yeah. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving here. So this is the first kind of basically ascetic practice, yeah, where you actually use pure willpower. This is like pure willpower, yeah, using mind against the mind, crushing out those things you don't like, trying to force those things that you like to kind of exist. And it sounds very painful. Yeah, it doesn't sound very nice at all. But one of the interesting things about this little passage, it is also found in one other place in the suttas. If you go to the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the calming of thoughts, Majjhima Nikaya number 20 is a very, very nice sutta. And if you haven't read it, I really recommend to read that sutta. It's all about how to calm down thoughts that are unwelcome, especially thoughts of sensuality and ill will, especially. And in that sutta, the Buddha gives five different ways that he used to overcome bad thoughts when they arose. And one of those ways, guess what it is? It's this way here, yeah? It's right there. So it's interesting. So what's going on there? How come in one sutta he teaches it as the path to awakening, and in another sutta he teaches it as the wrong view? What is going on? And what is going on is that in the sutta, in the Vitakka Santana Sutta, Majjhima 19, this method is only the very last of five methods. There are these other beautiful methods beforehand where you reflect in the right way on why the thought is dangerous, where you use substitution, you just kind of switch out that thought because you have other thoughts that are more powerful and better. There is just paying no attention to the thought. There is withdrawing the, what's it called? The Vitakka Sankara. I can't remember what it's called in Pali, but it doesn't matter. It's the motivation or the force behind the thought, the intention to think that you withdraw. And then all of these thoughts calm down as a consequence. And the point in that sutta is that if all of those four fail, then you come to this final method, yeah? If you get really desperate, if you're about to kill someone, yeah, or something like that, and you have to restrain yourself, okay, then you crush mind with mind, because you know killing somebody is not a good idea. So you hold yourself back, and you stop yourself from doing that, yeah? Okay, if you think the thought that you're going to kill somebody, that's okay. Yeah, just the thought is okay. But if you feel that that thought is becoming so strong, it's actually not okay. I'm really being silly. It's not okay. But if that thought becomes so strong that you actually start feeling that you're going to do it, that's when you really have a problem. And that's when you crush mind with mind, yeah? So it's like a desperate thing that you use as a very last resort if you feel that things are really getting out of hand. But it's a kind of thing that actually is very dangerous, you know? If you are a psychologist, you would basically warn against this kind of stuff, especially a person who is not ready for it, a person who already has maybe, you know, your psychology may not be entirely balanced. It's usually people who are a little bit unbalanced. They are the kind of people who hook on to these kind of methods, which is kind of strange, isn't it? Because people who are a little bit unbalanced, they are also often a little bit desperate to find a solution to their imbalances. And that's why they hook on to something which uses willpower, something they can use immediately. So be very, very careful. Don't recommend these kind of methods to anyone just willy-nilly. Be very careful with these methods. They are to be used only in exceptional circumstances. And here, in this particular case, the Buddha-to-be is using this as the entire path to awakening, yeah? That's a very different situation. And that is why, in this case, it is wrong view and it is the wrong idea. It just doesn't work like that. Of course, the Buddha-to-be, he is so mentally balanced that for him, he can do this without it affecting him badly. But for many people, it could lead to psychological imbalances. So he does all of this, and while he does this, he has a tireless energy. Yeah, the virya is tireless, so his mind is still powerful despite all that, all those problems. Unremitting mindfulness, it just means that mindfulness is stable. That's what it means, unremitting. It doesn't kind of slacken off. The body was overwrought. The Pali word for overwrought, the Pali word behind that basically means something like uncalm. Yeah? So he was like, the body was like restless or agitated or something like that. Yeah? My body was agitated and uncalm because of the effect of the painful feeling rather than being exhausted, because he had all this energy. Sounds a bit weird. He had tireless energy and he was exhausted. There's something not quite right about that. So he had tireless energy because of the effect of the painful striving, I think is a preferable translation there. Yeah. So this is the first Atta Kilamatanu Yogo. This is a beautiful word in the Pali Canon, which means self-torment. Atta is self. Kilamata is like tiring oneself. And anuyogo is being pursuing or practicing here. Atta Kilamatanu Yogo. That is the first one. Then we have, when he figures out that this doesn't work, he tries another method. And this is the next method coming up here. I thought, suppose I practice the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and the out-breaths through my mouth and nose. While I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. Just as there is a loud sound when a smith's bellows are blown, so too, when I stopped the in-breaths and my out-breaths through my nose and ears, there was a loud sound of wind coming out from my ear holes. But although my tireless energy, I got my fingers mixed up a little bit, was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was agitated and calm because of the effect of the painful striving here. So, you know, this person, this Buddha to be, he was pretty determined, yeah? He just holds his breath and from the mouth and nose until the breathing starts to happen through the ears instead. That's basically what he's saying here. You have to be really determined to do that sort of stuff. So the point here, yeah, the point really is that he pursued these things to extremes. I mean, he really tried. He really took things to the absolute end point. Yeah, it's hard to imagine how anyone can be so determined. Yeah, this is it's just almost mind-boggling when you read these kind of things. But the point, of course, is that this was his determination. This is the kind of determination you need if you're going to become a Buddha. Yeah, there's no shortcuts. You really have to kind of go for it. And then he continues with this breathless meditation. And just out of interest, the word for breathless meditation in Pali is the apanaka jhana. It's actually called jhana, yeah? The pana, like panatipata, the word pana means breath. Apanaka is non-breath, so the non-breath meditation, the breathless meditation. So, again, you have this, it's a very rare instance where the word jhana is used in a different way from the usual four jhanas. Why? Because here he's using a vocabulary that existed prior to the Buddha's kind of awakening. Yeah, he uses the vocabulary that existed in India at that time. The word jhana already existed, but it had a different meaning before the Buddha. That is what you are seeing here. That's why it's called the breathless jhana, the apanaka jhana. So he continues with this. I'm going to read through this fairly quickly because it's quite repetitive. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears. While I did so, violent winds cut through my head, just as if a strong man were to crush my head with the tip of a sharp sword. So too, or with the edge of a sharp sword perhaps, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears, violent winds cut through my head. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, my body was uncalm and agitated due to the effect of the painful striving here. One thing I should point out there is that the body being uncalm and agitated is problematic. Yeah, because if your body is agitated, it means that you cannot find the tranquility that leads to samadhi here. Samadhi requires tranquility. So he stops there. He can't go any further. He's blocking himself. He's blocking off the path to samadhi. Remember the path to samadhi? When we talk about the states arising on the mind, you have the You have the pamudra, the gladness leading to piti, which is joy, then pasadi, which is tranquility. He can't go beyond that state. He stops there because pasadi is not attainable when the body is agitated in this way. So that's why, this is one reason why this method can never work. So watch yourself, yes, when you meditate. What does it feel to have all that pain there? Do you feel relaxed, at ease and tranquil? Or do you feel slightly agitated by the pain? If the pain agitates you, basically you're having the same problem that the Buddha-to-be was having here. If you're able to stay completely tranquil and completely at ease with the pain, then it's not an issue for you. But if you find you're not able to do that, that is when it's an issue. The vast majority of people are not able to stay completely at ease with equanimity when the body is very painful. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears. While I did so, there were violent pains in my head, just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths from my mouth, nose and ears, there were violent pains in my head. And again, you have the same problem. You don't become tranquil, even though you have the energy and the mindfulness. Suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breath again through the mouth, nose and ears. And while I did so, violent winds carved up my belly, just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife. So too it happened with my belly, because of stopping the breathing in this way. And still, even though I had energy and mindfulness, I could not find that tranquility in the body. Suppose I practice it even further. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears. And while I did so, there was a violent burning in my body, just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals. Remarkable. So too, when I stopped the in-breath and out-breath through my mouth, nose and ears, there was a violent burning in my body. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought, was agitated and uncalm because of the effect of the painful striving. You remember, this was actually a person doing these things. This is almost quite likely a historical record of what actually happened. So that is why it is quite astonishing. That's why it is so, to read this kind of really brings you into what kind of person this person who was becoming the Buddha was, and the kind of determination that was required to get there. It's really quite remarkable. And then we have this little passage just to kind of drive home the point of what happens when you do this kind of stuff. Now, when the deities saw me, some said, the recluse Gotama is dead. Or the deities said, the recluse Gotama is not dead, he is just dying. Another deity said, the recluse Gotama is not dead nor dying, he is an arahant, for such is the way of the arahants. So the point here is that, the point I guess is just simply that he took things to the absolute max. You can't go any further than that. Either you die or you are an arahant. And of course, they didn't really know what arahants were. And this shows you, as I was saying the other day, that just because someone is a deity doesn't mean they know anything. They think that when you practice all this asceticism, or not really asceticism, all this torment and torture, and that means you're an arahant, they haven't got any more clue than anyone else. That's why you can never really trust the gods. So if the gods are going to give you the teachings of the Buddha, as you sometimes hear, it doesn't mean anything. They don't necessarily have a clue what is going on. And it shows you also the fact that even if the gods, even the deities, even the devas, they thought that self-torment was the path to awakening. Not just human beings. This rumor had traveled all the way up to the Devaloka. That kind of, this is the way to become an arahant. So it was a very, obviously very, I think the idea here is to show how pervasive that view was in ancient India. And as I mentioned before, not just in ancient India, but pretty much everywhere. if even the gods think so deeply, there's not many beings left who don't believe in these things. So he has now exhausted that way of trying to achieve awakening. That hasn't worked, so now he's going to try another way here. And there's a funny little passage here which I'm not sure exactly how to understand. But anyway, I'll read it out anyway. I thought, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food. Then the deities came to me and said, good sir, do not practice entirely cutting off food. If you do so, we shall infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and you will live on that. I considered, if I claim to be completely fasting while these deities infuse heavenly food into the pores of my skin, and I live on that, then I shall be lying. So I dismissed those deities, saying, there is no need. And then he thinks, I thought, suppose I take very little food, a handful at each meal, whether of bean soup or lentil soup or veg soup or pea soup. So before I go on, it's a curious little paragraph. This one about the deities coming to put heavenly food into your pores of your skin. I really don't know exactly how to understand that. To me, it sounds like something which didn't really happen. I find it very hard to imagine how heavenly beings can infuse food into the pores of your skin. It sounds very strange, the whole thing. And I wonder what is happening here, because in the next paragraph, he says, I will take very little food. Yeah. And maybe that this paragraph was added later on to show why the Buddha decided to take little food rather than taking no food. Yeah, so how do we explain that the Buddha takes little food rather than no food? Shouldn't the Buddha to be practiced completely? Yeah, absolutely cutting off all food. Well, this kind of gives you the explanation why he did not cut off food completely, because the deities were going to infuse heavenly food into the pores of his skin. That's what it seems like to me. It sounds like almost like an excuse that has been added later on to excuse the Buddha from having to fast completely. You see what I mean? It's almost as if the later generations, they were not quite happy with the Buddha eating. Yeah, he hasn't tried fully. Yeah, we have to explain this somehow. How come he doesn't try fully? This is the reason why he didn't try fully. And then this passage kind of got in there. Yeah, I remember the story. Yeah, these devas came around and they said something. Yeah, what did they say? You know how the imagination works. That's how it goes. Yeah, and then somehow these things that gradually gets added into the suttas. And that's why comparative study is so interesting, because sometimes it draws out precisely which passages have been added later on in this way. Unfortunately, there is no parallel to this sutta in the Chinese Agamas, and the reason for that is a bit of a complex reason. The reason is because in the Agamas, this sutta is found in a different Agama, depending on the tradition you look at. So it doesn't mean the sutta doesn't exist in those schools of Buddhism. It just means it doesn't exist in the Agamas. But it does exist in Sanskrit. Unfortunately, that Sanskrit version was only discovered a couple of decades ago somewhere in Afghanistan. Yeah, in Afghanistan is this country where they sometimes dig things out of the ground. Yeah, this ancient kind of vase that are sealed on top. And they open the seal, they look inside, and they get these ancient manuscripts, the script they can't read. Yeah, today Afghanistan is a Muslim country. It used to be a Buddhist country. Yeah? This is Sanskrit that they pull out, yeah, of these ancient vases. And then they get sold on the black market somewhere. Some collector usually in the West or in Japan or something like that. A collector of manuscripts goes to these black markets, buys these manuscripts, and they get hidden away in some cellar in some Western country, in the US or in the UK or something like that, until someone realizes what it actually is. But for goodness sake, it's the Digha Nikaya you got there. Why are you collecting this in your cellar? Somebody can make use of this one. Oh yeah, you have a point. Okay. Then it comes out again. Yeah. And then eventually we get hold of these manuscripts. That's how these things work. It's very strange. And so gradually all these manuscripts from there, they kind of come back. Yeah. And this particular manuscript was discovered about 20 years ago, and it turns out it is a version in Sanskrit of the Diga Nikaya, or the Dirga Agama, of the Sarvastivaden school. That's what it was. And in that Dirga Agama of the Sarvastivaden school, you find which sutta? This sutta. It's there. So in their collection, it was found in the Diga Nikaya. In our collection, it's found in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is one of the reasons why it can be hard to find the suttas, because they are in different collections. So that is getting a bit sidetracked again, but I apologize for these sidetracks, but I get a bit excited about these things. So I look forward to seeing this, you know, when this is compared. And I think maybe, we shall see, but there might be some chance that this passage possibly is missing in the Sarvastivaden version. Anyway, we shall find out when it's all edited and translated, yeah? So if you come back in a couple of lifetimes, then we may be able to find out what's going on. Don't hold your breath, because these things take long, long time before they get released and things. So that is my preliminary take on why that is there. Otherwise, it makes no sense to me, that particular paragraph. It really doesn't. Anyway, so he goes on a fast, yeah? He takes only a handful of food at every meal, a handful of food a day. And then he says, so I took very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup or lentil soup or veg soup or pea soup. When I did so, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. Because of eating so little, the projections of my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down into the sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has sunk down, far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a green, bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. Thus, if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. And if I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I defecated and urinated, I fell over on my face right there. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. So again, he doesn't mess around. Yeah, he really gets down to business when he gets into these. It's almost too much when you read this. It's almost kind of, when you see that famous statue of the Buddha before his awakening, when he's kind of very thin, you may have seen that. I think we have one here somewhere on the premises, maybe out there somewhere. First of all, remember, it's never the Buddha. It's not a Buddha statue. It's a Bodhisattva statue. Yeah? It's the Buddha before his awakening. Yeah? And it's a statue which basically shows you wrong view. So remember that. It's a wrong view statue. It's not a Buddha statue. It's a wrong view statue. Yeah? That's a nice way of thinking about it, because often we look at these things and we take them in the wrong way, but actually they're not really what they are, what this might seem to be. So very, very graphic description here. Yeah, and again, to think that actually someone actually did this, the Buddha actually did this, is kind of absolutely astonishing. Yeah? One of the little things that I find very powerful about this, and it's almost difficult to read sometimes, because this is the Buddha, this is like the supreme spiritual master, you know, in living memory. And then it says things like, because of eating so little, if I defecated and urinated, I fell over on my face right there. It's like so direct. Yeah, it's so kind of immediate. It's so human. It's so kind of, you know, that is almost too much. Because you put the Buddha up there on a pedestal, and here, kind of his humanity is right there, stands out kind of directly in front of you. And I think there is a reason why the Buddha is so direct. There is a reason for this. It is precisely to shock us a little bit back into reality. He is a human being. He is one of us in a very real sense. And by reading these things, it reminds you that he is precisely a human being. So he kind of, I think, perhaps, I don't know, but I assume there is usually a purpose behind everything he says. And to do this, he actually, again, makes this point. He did this. He is a human being. We are human beings. We can follow in his footsteps and do exactly the same thing here. So, that is the third kind of ascetic practice, whereby you kind of, the body almost disappears because you eat so little. So you stop the breathing, you try to beat down mind with mind, and now he's coming to his wits' ends. What to do next? Yeah, what do you do after this? Now when people saw me, some said, the recluse Gotama is black. Other people said, the recluse Gotama is not black, he is brown. Other people said, the recluse Gotama is neither black nor brown, he is golden skinned. So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. I thought, I'm not entirely sure what it probably just means that, you know, again, it just to show the severity of his practices probably is what really that is about. I thought, whatever recluses and Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feeling due to exertion. This is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion. This is the most. There is nothing beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins at present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion. This is the utmost. There is none beyond this. He has taken it to its extreme. He has taken it to death's door. Take it one step further and he will pass away. That will be the end of it. Yeah? He has taken it even with his incredible mental powers. There is no further way to go down that track. So instead of then continuing aimlessly down the same path, he takes a step back and he asks himself, what next? What am I supposed to do now? Sensuality doesn't work. I have to give that up. It's impossible to get awakened when, as long as your mind is affected by sensuality. This path also doesn't work. Yeah, it just can't take it any further. All it has given rise to is agitation and lack of calm. Yeah, in the body, and that agitation and lack of calm stops you from taking the mind any further, stops the samadhi, stops all those other potentials of the mind. What now? This is what's coming up now, yeah? This is where it starts to get really exciting here. What next? But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman quality and a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. These are very kind of important words in the suttas. Superhuman qualities, the uttari manusa dhamma, they mean something like, dhamma means like qualities, uttari manusa means beyond human, yeah, beyond the human state, beyond what humanity normally experiences. These are qualities beyond ordinary human qualities. Yeah, these in the suttas always means two things, these qualities. They always refer to the four jhanas and the four stages of awakening. These are the stages beyond ordinary human qualities. When you get to that point, you are already like a Brahma or a Arahant or whatever. And the other one here is the distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. This is the Alangarya Nanadasana Visesa. Yeah. And so knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, what are they? That's also the four jhanas and the four stages of awakening here. And that is already very, very interesting, the fact that the jhanas and the stages of awakening are always classified together like that. Yeah, we always tend to think of the stages of awakening as the absolute pinnacle, the apex of the pyramid of spiritual powers, the spiritual, the very top of the pyramid. But actually, in the suttas, the way that these things are explained, almost always the four stages of awakening and the four jhanas are placed together. And that is a very important point, because it tells you something about the profundity of these things we call the jhanas. There's a lot of, if you go on the internet, there's always this endless discussions about what the jhanas actually are. And some say, you get a bit of piti, sukha, you got the first jhana, yeah. But actually, it doesn't match with how they're described in the suttas. These are extraordinarily profound things. They're almost the very last thing that happens before awakening itself happens. They are called in the suttas the Sambodha Sukha, the happiness of awakening. The happiness of jhanas is essentially the same as the happiness of awakening experience themselves. They are at the same level. They always go together. So what we are talking about here are things that are almost indistinguishable from the stages of awakening. There's only a little bit of insight that is missing. That is really the only difference. And this is so important, to be able to interpret these things in the right way, to understand how profound they actually are. You are at the door to awakening itself. That is what it means. So both the jhanas and the awakening stages are out of reach. Yeah, this is what basically he's saying here. He can't really go beyond this. He's stuck with his body. He has emaciated the body so much, done so many harsh practices, that the body he's stuck with that. He can't go beyond it. Just like we are stuck with the body if you've got too much pain in your knees, yeah? You know what I mean? You've got too much pain in your knees. You get stuck there because the mind goes out to the pain all the time. Oh no, how am I going to do that? Okay, just watch. Oh no, can't watch, can't bear. Okay, watch more. Okay, back and forth. Yeah, and you don't get anywhere. Why? Because the mind gets obsessed with that pain. You almost become that pain. So be very careful with that. Enjoy the practice. And then comes the question, could there be another path to awakening? Yeah? And just as I said that, it turned 5 o'clock. Yeah? So it means we have to stop. Yeah? So we get back to that tomorrow morning. Yeah. So exciting. A cliffhanger. Okay. Okay. Very good. Okay. We'll see you again at 7:30 this evening.